Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
More fallout at Milwaukee Public Schools with calls to recall 4 school board members. We also tell you what Governor Evers had to say about the current financial crisis. Plus, the state's high court issues a ruling on the use of mobile voting vans just 5 months out from the presidential race. And we have the highlights from the Democratic State Convention held in Milwaukee last weekend. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for June 14th.
Hi, I'm Emily Vannon.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This week, we're going to begin with more Milwaukee Public Schools and their accounting crisis. We're going to talk about the corrective action plan that they submitted to DPI this week, but also new efforts seeking to recall some of the school board members amid this accounting crisis. Here are a list of the individuals that a grassroots group is targeting. There are specifically 4 board members, some who have been there the longest, and they submitted this effort, which is going to be a little bit of a tall task because you have to collect thousands of signatures to do this. But that doesn't mean there's a lot of voters who are passionate about this, that it's not impossible. So looking at our next slide kind of shows the thresholds that would be needed for signatures to recall these certain individuals. Of course, you're looking at the vice president there, Marva, and then Missy Zombar. She is, of course, represents the city, across the city, excuse me. That's why she has the most signatures with a little bit over 44,000. Now, this effort comes as there has been a series of departures at MPS. You know, it was just last week, Superintendent Keith Posley resigned. They lost their CFO, their comptroller, and there's going to be more of a domino effect because we could potentially lose more school board members, and we know there's a series of vacancies at MPS as well. This all comes as they also approved a $1.5 billion budget late Thursday night despite this financial crisis. One school board member voted against it, and they did. So the main argument was is that they got to pass this budget so they can operate. They still have to pay staff, and they have to still plan for the next school year, despite likely going to have to figure out how to make up $30 to $50 million, those are estimates, from MPS, because they have to offset their budget because they were overpaid due to multiple errors in their reporting. So this kind of leads on to our next conversation, is that we've been waiting. When is MPS going to get this corrective action plan together so they can pass this budget and start making some corrections to their mistakes in the past? So let's detail some of this action plan that they submitted. So on Tuesday, they sent it into DPI, and it details more than 130 tasks to try and get the district's finances in order. Now, implementing the fixes will be a huge lift for the department that is severely understaffed. This is what we found in the report. There are 8 vacant positions right now in the financial office, and it calls for hiring at least 12 people. And in midst of all this financial chaos, we also spoke to Governor Tony Evers this week, who, of course, was the head of the Department of Public Instruction before he was elected governor, and is very passionate. You know, he talks about he was the education governor when he ran back in 2018. We talked to him about, what do you think about DPI, who has known for more than 8 months about this mismanagement at MPS? Should they have let the public know sooner? Should more of the school board members gotten a heads up before they did 3 weeks ago, is what they say. Let's hear from the governor what he said about that. And in short summary, he called it, it was wrong that DPI didn't get this information out sooner. So let's take a listen to what he had to say.
I would think if there's any concern I have, and I'm obviously supportive of the DPI, but to allow it to happen at this point in time without notifying the school board or others, I think that was a mistake on their part.
On DPI's part.
Absolutely. They need to keep people informed and the leadership informed. And if we're eight months post, I think, of the date actually getting the information in, they should have been reaching, if they couldn't get the people that are working there, getting paid to work there to do the good work, they should have gone to the board. But that's all water over the dam now. We just have to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
The governor had a lot to say about MPS, I'll say that. But we also just want to highlight this also comes after his administration said that they will go forth with a pair of audits examining MPSs, not only just their finances, but their academic performance going forward. And it's a task that Evers even said it could take more than a year. He estimated spring of 2025, which concerns some people that it's going to take that long, but audits are no simple task.
In talking to people this week, one thing that was brought to me was the contrast of how Evers has approached the corrections problems and the MPS problems. Now, corrections, talked about last week, the charges at Waupun, all that kind of good stuff. That is Tony Evers' responsibility. It is part of the administration. He oversees Waupun. MPS, you could argue, really isn't his problem. Yes, he's the education governor, but that is a separate entity, a local government, governmental unit. DPI really has the mud in its shoes for kind of dropping the ball and not letting people know about what was going on. But look how more aggressive Evers has responded to MPS than corrections. The point made to me was this is where Governor Evers is comfortable. He is an education guy. He was state superintendent. He was a local educator. He knows this stuff. Yes, he wants to help Milwaukee. Yes, it is an issue that kind of maybe gets on his shoes a little bit because he's the governor, but this is where he's more comfortable. And therefore, he's more going to be more aggressive in the response than with corrections, where he's saying to the sheriff, please keep your investigation open. We want to keep this going forward. But this hasn't really been as passionate a response to the problems there.
And I also asked the governor, too, earlier this week, is that would he want to see any changes at MPS going forward, basically of how it governs itself, given it was just last week we heard from former Governor Tommy Thompson saying he wants to dissolve MPS. You know, we've known about those calls from Republicans for many, many years. And like you said, Jer, as long as you've been here, mm-hmm. they've never gone anywhere, right? And we know that there's an emphasis from Evers even saying last week that he would like to have Milwaukee County Executive, the Milwaukee Mayor, to have more involvement in MPS. They kind of took that hands off. They don't really want to touch that right now. So these are all ideas that are still floating around, but Evers doesn't really want to make that decision. He also says he was made aware of this whole financial situation when the media did. So we'll see if his administration actually knew about it sooner or not, but that's what the governor is claiming too. So there's by no means this issue is going to go anywhere, but they did pass the budget. They are taking steps. They've made this corrective action plan to start taking steps to get their stuff in order. So we'll see what happens in the coming weeks and months ahead before the next school year starts. All right, let's move on to kind of on our election block mm-hmm. of what we're going to cover here with a lot of things that we're first going to start with the Wisconsin Elections Commission dropping some challenges to candidates on the ballot. Two of them we're going to highlight, and that's State Representative Dora Drake from Milwaukee and Tony Weed. He is the Trump-backed candidate for the 8th Congressional District. And Drake survived the challenge from her opponent, Representative Lakeisha Myers, who's also a Milwaukee Democrat, and Weed, like I said, who was endorsed by Trump. His signatures were also upheld.
So look, I've watched lots and lots of Elections Commission meetings with challenges, nomination papers. They aren't often successful. With Myers and Drake, one of the things was Myers said Dora Drake used the wrong nomination papers. There are partisan offices in Wisconsin and nonpartisan offices. Dora Drake used papers for a nonpartisan office to collect signatures for a partisan office. Now, Elections Commission said, look, she wrote Democratic Party at the top of them. There was an indication that she was running for a partisan office, and they were substantially in compliance. That's the key phrase with Elections Commission almost all the time. Was it substantially in compliance? They wrote Drake's was. The challenge goes away. Now, Myers has said she might challenge that in court, but look, we're on a fast timeline. Remember, they're on two different ballots. They're on the special election ballot in July to fill the rest of this term of Lena Taylor's. It goes to the end of this year, well, actually early January, and then the fall ballot for the full four-year term. It's all about the fall ballot, the one that really matters mm-hmm. in the scheme of things. So Myers may go to court to challenge that. So there's that piece. Tony Weed, this is an example of people raise allegations all the time, these challenges that aren't backed up. So this guy who sued Green Bay along with Andre Jacques, who's running in the 8th Congressional District, by the way, filed a challenge saying that he personally witnessed people collecting signatures for Tony Weed, who fraudulently posed what he's collecting signatures for, that they said this was not for Tony Weed, but something else. He presented no affidavits from a voter who said they were duped, no other evidence, no corroboration, just his words saying, this was fraud. You should throw out everything because of what I said. I have yet to see a challenge based on that succeed. So, again, Elections Commission said there's nothing here we can really go act on, so that goes away. There were a couple of challenges that were upheld or that were successful, other problems with signatures. One thing I thought was interesting was Remember, the papers are usually due June 1st every year. Because it was a Saturday, they had to be turned in June 3rd. There was a challenge saying that this one person collected signatures after 5 o'clock on June 1st. Anything collected after that should be thrown out, and therefore they should be off the ballot because they have enough without those extra 2 days. The commission rejected that, saying, actually, we told candidates they had extra time. Why is that important? Because Robin Voss, in his challenge of the recall petition against him, raised the same issue. Remember, the recall petition 60-day window ended on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend. They couldn't accept it until Tuesday. There are signatures from after Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, and Robin says those should be thrown out. That's going to come into play when the commission rules on Robin's petition or the recall petition against Robin at the end of June.
Right, and we're going to get to that in a moment, but I just want to mention, too, during that WEC meeting as well, Ann Jacobs, a Democrat, was elected as the new chair going forward. So new leadership shift there as well. All right, let's get to the recall, too, and the latest, because you kind of hinted towards that, JR. The Racing Recall Committee did claim this week that Speaker Voss The Racing Recall Committee claimed that Speaker Voss' challenge to its petition should be rejected because Voss didn't follow the proper procedure in filing it. So organizers argued, this is just their argument, that Voss's attorney verified the complaint against the second batch of recall signatures rather than the Speaker.
So this recall committee has been interesting yet again, and I don't mean interesting in a good way. So Voss filed his challenge on Friday. He says, one, there are 9,000 signatures that were turned in overall. Roughly 2,000, Voss says, were not from the 63rd Assembly District. Another 330, roughly, are that issue I talked about where they're collected after that deadline in his mind. Another batch was thrown out. If all three were accepted, they'd be below the 6,850 they need to recall Robin Voss. The bigger thing that Voss challenged was, you can't recall me from a district that basically doesn't exist anymore. Remember, Robin Voss elected the 63rd Assembly District in 2022. Supreme Court says those maps don't exist anymore. They're invalid. They can't be used going forward. Robin argues you have to recall me from the 33rd Assembly District, where I live now, on the new maps. So this can't happen. Oh, by the way, you can't apply these petitions to that district because they didn't say 33rd on the district. It said 63rd. Ergo, this can't go forward. Now, I don't know what's the right answer. None of us really do, because no court has weighed in and said, this is the map you must use. However, Robin Voss has plenty of fodder to challenge us in court to make it moot. So let's get back to the back and forth between the recall committee and Robin Voss. The recall committee is arguing that Robin Voss's challenge failed to follow state law, that it he didn't personally sign it, essentially, his lawyer did. I've seen lots of things submitted to the Elections Commission signed by an attorney, not by the candidate, him or herself. So I don't know how far that will get. Often say not a lawyer,
right?
But in my experience, those don't go very far. This recall committee, oddly enough, told us they're going to have a news conference on Tuesday to talk about their response to Robin's challenge. We show up, the door is locked, then they say, nope, we're not doing it anymore.
It was also in the assembly chambers, and yes. Who controls the assembly chambers?
The next day, they put out a statement, we don't have to respond to this challenge because it fails to follow state law. That's why they had the news conference the day before, because we have this surprise discovery about this problem with this petition, mm-hmm. this challenge. Then I got at 4:40 p.m. on Wednesday the rebuttal, the challenge that raised all this stuff. So they're operating in an odd way. Why I bring this up is every time I ask people about this recall, they go, why did they bother doing it this way? So also this week, Andrew Sigelski, who is the conservative writer, employer, works for an industrial oven company in East Troy, dropped out of the race at like, he sent us a statement at like midnight Monday. So Andrew said there were circumstances beyond his control, so why he dropped out. We've talked before, he's got legal problems in his background. People I talked to think he may have realized that the mugshots that are on file of him from his younger days were going to be splashed across mail pieces. That is not fun. If you've had something bad in your life happen to you and it's something that's in the public record and you're in an office, yes, there's that issue. Okay, he dropped out after the ballot had been already approved by the Elections Commission, so he'll be on the ballot, but he's not running. And I know we in this very complicated picture, right? Here's the simple part of it. Robin Voss is in a 65% Republican district. He has no active challenger in the GOP primary for that Republican district. It's hard to see somebody not running beating him in the primary, right? there is an independent on the ballot who is part of the recall effort. I have yet to see an independent be able to split the GOP vote in half in an assembly district. That would have to happen to allow the former Lake Geneva mayor running as a Democrat in the district to have a shot. So there's not a legitimate path right now to see Robin Voss losing in August and November. With the recall, even if it's approved, what's it matter? If they recalled him, yes, it would be embarrassing, you know, to have that happen. Reality is, if the Elections Commission approves the recall at the end of June, Robin will be in court the next day saying, you can't do it from the 63rd. We've both covered court cases before. They take a while. That would be the end of June, early July. Have you seen many cases get resolved all the Supreme Court in 6 months?
Absolutely not.
So then January 2nd, it becomes moot because the term has ended. Ergo, Robin Voss is basically not in the clear, but he's in pretty good shape where he's got a headache. He's got Donald Trump coming.
Of course.
Might give him a grief, but he's in a pretty good place right now to be in the assembly come January of 2025.
And those are the questions we have talked to the recall organizers for many times. Why not just have someone primary him or say this recall is legit, all the signatures are okay, they meet the threshold. Well, then who's going to run to replace him? It's just the timeline, the numbers, it just might not seem to fruition.
So then why?
Yeah.
Michael Gableman wanted to be in the Trump administration the last go around. Michael Gableman is a big figure in this effort. Mm-hmm. Michael Gableman might want to be in a Trump administration for the new one
thing.
In January.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sneaky suspicion by some people that all Gableman cares about is getting Robin Voss to a recall to make Trump happy, because Trump does not like Robin Voss. Now, is that a conspiracy theory? Maybe. But it kind of makes sense in an odd way when you think about all the things that have been done with this entire thing.
All right, let's move on to our next election story impacting our elections, and it comes after the state Supreme Court kept a lower court's ruling banning the use of mobile voting vans for the upcoming presidential race, like when Racine did in 2022 by allowing ballots to be cast in such van. Now, the ruling also ensured that municipalities can use a law from 2016 to determine where to place early voting sites. So voting sites, okay. Voting vans, no.
So this ruling is kind of complicated, all right? So the judge back in January said you can't use this van from August of 2022 because state law isn't supposed to authorize it. However, he agreed with an analysis that the conservative Wisconsin Institute of Law and Liberty did, finding that the places Racine went to have these alternate absentee voting sites benefited Democrats. What complicates is several things. One, this is originally a complaint filed with the Elections Commission, dismissed it. They went to court. The judge overturned it. So it triggers some different legal processes. But you read the decision from this week, and the court's saying, okay, we're not going to issue a stay of the prohibition on the vans. Okay, that's clear. They got in the weeds, though, about this other piece. They're saying, we're going to stay the ruling about this was a partisan advantage, this part. The conservatives in the court say, you're basically staying not an order, but a rationale. Mm-hmm. We don't do that. I know it's complicated, but the Supreme Court, basically, lawyers tell me, wants to make sure there isn't any confusion that municipalities can have multiple alternate voting sites, absentee voting sites. Okay, that's been allowed. That is clear. They don't want any confusion. The clear bottom line is this. You will vote absentee this election the same way you did 2 years ago.
Right.
Nothing is going to change. There are lots of lawyers going to dive into lots of stuff in this case as it moves forward.
Of course, and we know there's going to be a lot more election issues that come to the court as well moving forward. All right. Also, just want to briefly mention that there's also a new chief of elections in the city of Milwaukee. So this comes just under 5 months to the presidential election after the Milwaukee Common Council voted to confirm Paulina Gutierrez to lead the city's elections commission. Now, this comes after Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson nominated Gutierrez to the position, which was a surprise move last month to replace Claire Woodall, who served about a decade at the Elections Commission. Now, Woodall is still helping Gutierrez, get familiar with the role. And, you know, this comes after this will be her first federal election that she ever worked. So there was criticism after Mayor Johnson appointed her. A lot of conservatives were upset with it. There was also Milwaukee Common Council members that were upset about it. They have said since, for the past month, that those concerns have eased. But when it comes to Republicans, I spoke to Representative Krug, who is the chairman of the Campaign and Elections. He said he still just thinks this is an issue, given that his whole part of his committee this year has been trying to restore faith in our elections. And he feels like this is one more thing that voters could point to if there are problems come Milwaukee in August and November. So something to watch for going forward. But as I said, there's a lot of people that are now backing her, even after it was a very, you know, shock to the system that Woodall would no longer be in that position. But she is getting some necessary tools of what individuals I talked to this week to be in charge. All right, let's get on to the next topic, which is recapping the state Democratic convention, which was last weekend at the Potawatomi Hotel and Casino in Milwaukee. Now, some just headlines that came out of it is, of course, Democrats were very critical of former President Donald Trump, while also touting President Biden's achievements, such as more jobs and making health care more affordable. The party also adopted a resolution calling for a ceasefire in the war against Gaza after protests erupted during the two-day convention, specifically interrupting Senator Tammy Baldwin. Despite that, let's just hear from Baldwin and the lieutenant governor kind of on some of their talking points and highlights from the convention real quick.
Wisconsin is going to be the battleground state on November 5th. We will determine who wins the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. And we will determine whether our country moves forward. And when all is said and done, when all of the chips are on the table and every vote is counted, we will look back and say, we did everything in our power to move our state and our country forward.
It's hard to imagine an election that is more important than this one for women, for working families, for freedoms, and the future of our democracy. This is a critical moment in our history. We are standing at a crossroads this year, being challenged to reaffirm our values and choose our path as a nation.
Jer, what are some of the other takeaways that you got out of the last weekend's convention?
A lot of tension on Israel-Palestine thing. So look, during Baldwin's speech Saturday night, there were half a dozen people pulled out. Several were carrying cell phones, taped themselves while they're being pulled out. So not to be an old man cynic, but maybe some self-promotion there going on, drawing attention to themselves and their cause. The Democrats sold tickets to the convention. You could be a delegate, an alternate, or a guest. Suspicion is that some people who bought tickets to be guests just to interrupt the speech. So is it a huge rift? Maybe, maybe not. Likewise, Sunday morning with the debate about the ceasefire resolution, there were, of the 1,200 tickets sold, 640-ish were delegates, only people allowed to vote on the resolutions. Of that 640, like just more than 200 participated. And of that 200, like 55% voted for the ceasefire resolution. So what I'm getting at is this is not a huge voice in the Democratic Party, even in the activist base that comes to a convention. However, if you extrapolate out from those 600-some people to like the broader universe of Democrats, even if it's 5%, if you lose 5% in November, Joe Biden, you're in trouble. So I don't know that this is a major voice or a dominant voice in the party. It follows the unobstructed vote, which was like 9% of the vote in the April primary. Like, there's an issue. Can Joe Biden win these folks back before November?
Right. And, of course, in a state that is often decided by 1 or 2 percentage points, 5% can make a difference. All right. We also just want to look ahead to next week, of course, because the former president is coming back to Wisconsin to hold a rally in Racine on Tuesday. It comes as though he's getting a lot of criticism this week for comments that he made to about the city of Milwaukee in a closed-door meeting with the House delegation in D.C. I'm going to start from what was first reported is that he called Milwaukee a horrible city. It was reported by Punchbowl News. That later then got different answers of what he was referring to. We spoke to, I know you did too, a lot of the Wisconsin congressional delegation. You know, were you first in the room? What did you hear? Some people said he didn't say that at all. You also had other congressmen saying that he was referring to crime. You had other individuals that we talked to say that he was talking about elections. Well, in the end, on Fox News on Thursday night, Donald Trump did clarify that he was talking about crime and elections in Milwaukee. When it comes to elections, though, we know that he keeps spewing falsehoods about the 2020 election, that he won in Wisconsin, that is completely untrue. Regardless of all of the news circulating around this, I think it's fair to say, JR, this is going to be something he's likely to bring up in Racine next week.
That and Robin Voss. Those are the things I'd be watching for is, does he go after the speaker in his own backyard? He did at a rally in Waukesha 2 years ago, so watching for that.
And Democrats, of course, already have billboards up. They're eating this up. Will it matter? I think that's the big question, because it's only June. You know, we've got a little bit till November. All right, let's get the stock picks. We're running out of time here. Rising this week is tourism spending in the state.
So if you saw more Illinois license plates in Wisconsin last year than you did the year before, wasn't a mistake. Tourism is up, another record year. Want to look ahead a little bit. 2024 had a warm winter. Was that going to hurt northern Wisconsin for tourism? Maybe a good summer will help rebound. In 2025, the draft is going to come. Also, don't forget the Joint Finance Committee a week ago approved $5 million for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation to attract big-time events to Wisconsin, half of what the agency asked for. So we'll see how that money plays into the future tourism numbers down the road.
All right, and let's get to Mix this week, which is Susan Crawford, who is the Dane County judge who officially launched her bid for state Supreme Court in 2025.
Which is no surprise. Yeah. The second Ann Walsh Bradley announced she wasn't going to run, her name popped up. She's been stout in saying she's considering, even as Chris Taylor kicked the tires, the Dane County judge, Pedro Colon, the first District Court of Appeals judge, Crawford has been a consistent presence of, I'm going to run for this race. And you've seen Democrats coalesce around her the entire time. Now, my questions are, she announced June 10th. The end of the fundraising period is June 30th. Got 20 days to raise money. Now, the big money is going to come from the state party.
Of course.
Give that in a second. But, you know, a little bit of pressure to kind of show a good number. What's that number got to be? Good question. Brad Schimmel has raised at least $500,000 through the middle of May, he told me. So can she doesn't top him, but have a respectable one. Then two, does she have the stomach for what's going to come? She's described as not a bomb thrower, kind of a quiet person. This is going to be an intense race. I counted $56 million spent on the race last year. This is again for control of the state Supreme Court. Conservatives say they've learned their lesson from 2023. They are going to be engaged and active. Maybe. We'll see. The state GOP has not proven yet it can raise the kind of money the Democrats can. But does she have the fire in the belly for this race? Brad Schimmel does. He's been through two statewide races. He's won statewide. He's also lost statewide. He's already chosen to be more aggressive. We saw right away the gate. Him calling her like a handpicked activist working for people who don't share our values, that kind of thing. So already a better candidate than Daniel Kelly was, although a low bar for Kelly, the former justice who lost in 2020 and 2023. But I'm watching this race really is the money. So the Democratic Party of Wisconsin is a machine. Will donors on the right say, okay, we learned our lesson. We're not going to send money to outside groups because the real sweet spot is money to the party, party to the candidate. Candidates the best rates on TV ads, ergo you get more bang for your buck from a candidate buying an ad than an outside group. Will they learn that lesson? We shall see. People are a little skeptical, one, that the Republican Party can raise that kind of money. And then two, don't forget presidential race. If Donald Trump wins, this race will play out against the backdrop of his first 100 days in office. Imagine the passion on the left if that's going on, right? That makes Schimmel's job way tougher. And then two, abortion. It's still a salient issue. If Trump wins, it'll be that much more. It's not going to go away no matter what.
I was just going to bring that up, right.
Doesn't matter if Biden wins or what. It'll just be much more intense if Trump's in office, that issue.
Yeah, and we know even Crawford mentioned in her her launch that I used to work for Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. So she already looks like she's going to try to bank on that issue of abortion, which was very successful, of course, with Justice Janet Protasiewicz's campaign. All right, we got about 30 seconds left. Following this week is Jim Troupas, a former Trump attorney who was recently charged by Attorney General Josh Call for his role in the fake elector scheme.
And this week, the state Supreme Court suspends him temporarily from this committee that advises judges on ethics. So now the court majority has flipped from 4-3 conservative when it reappointed Troupas on 3 years to 4-3 liberal. It's a 6-0 decision. Justice Rebecca Bradley didn't participate. Kind of curious why she did not. But look, when the court reappointed him 18 months ago, it was tone deaf at best to appoint somebody to this body who had this stuff going on. The question is now, like, does he ever get back on? And is this going to be kind of the first hit for him? Will he ever actually be convicted? Will he plead the case with Josh Call? initial appearance in September. It's going to take a while. That's the real problem for Jim Troupas. This is kind of embarrassing, but that's the real issue for him up there is legal charges.
All right. That will do it for another slow week in politics. All right. That will do it. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, Your Week in Review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.